Sydney, and it's with many of us. He did his PhD here at Wharton and his undergrad. And he escaped the cold weather here to go to New Mexico, and we crossed paths there, unfortunately, I would say. And now he's in Australia, so kind of gone like this.
Yeah.
And I'd say he's got the better deal, at least in winter. And today he's going to be telling us about some new work he's been doing on tomography. And it's sort of a rethinking of the way that tomography is done.
Thanks. Right, so some work I did late last year. So there's the archive number. I guess it was also published in PRL. I don't know the reference, but if you go to the archive, it has all the information there. Right, so I guess I don't need to remind this audience too much about tomography, but I'll just go through the standard spiel. So, you know, suppose you have some black box, some company gives it to you, promises that it's going to produce some state, and you want to verify that, or you just out in the lab and you'd like to know what your, you know, what, how to quantum mechanically describe your physical system. So we know that a preparation procedure is described by some density matrix rho. And we can't just look at the state, so we have to do quantum measurements. And every outcome of a quantum measurement is represented by some other positive operator that I've represented here as E, with some subscript denoting which outcome I got. So I get a whole list of these outcomes, which are just these positive operators. Okay, so you know, the rules of quantum mechanics dictate that there's some distribution of outcomes, and that distribution is characterized by Born's rule. So if I knew what the state was, then I just used deduction, logical deduction, to determine the distribution of outcomes. But suppose I didn't know what the state was, but instead I had all of this statistical data encoded in these outcomes of measurements. Well, there are many states compatible with a given data set, so I need to choose a unique one. And that's the process of induction. So this is an inverse problem. OK, so by now, the field is quite huge. There's a vast literature in need of a reviewed article about this. And a lot of time, these will focus on specific questions. And there's some sort of logical order if you're sort of a decision theorist. So you should start with a figure of merit. If the true state is rho and I say sigma, well, there should be some number that tells me how bad that was, right? So I need to decide on which is the right figure of merit. Maybe it's trace distance, maybe it's fidelity, maybe it's relative entropy, maybe it's some other measure. Once I do that, I can start to think about, well, what estimator is best for this figure of merit? Maybe it's maximum likelihood, maybe it's least squares, maybe it's matrix lasso or some other regularization technique. And then you might say, well, you know, I want more than a single estimate. I want to know how confident you are in that estimate. So I need to put error bars on that or regions. And after all of that, you might say, OK, well, I've set up the problem fairly formally. Now I can start to think about which measurements I should do, because I have this freedom of choice to do these quantum measurements. And then, you know, it gets more and more complicated. And there's lots of powerful techniques now to do such things. But I'm going to think about it a little bit differently. And let me just get straight to the punchline so you know where I'm going. So instead of thinking about this paradigm where I have all this measurement data, and now tell me what the state is, I'm going to just start sort of a more direct approach. And so it's going to be an adaptive measurement scheme, and I'm going to throw out the data as it's arriving and just adaptively change my estimate. I'm going to do this in such a way that the measurement choice that I make encodes a description of the state. So as I'm doing new measurements, I'm changing my estimate. And so at the end, when the protocol halts, the last measurement that I do is the state that I think it is. Okay, so that's why I call it self-learning. or self-guided. Okay, that sounds great. Now I don't have to do this inversion problem. But of course, you know, there's no free lunch. And what we'll observe is a trade-off between measurement complexity and and computational complexity. And what I mean by that is the complexity of solving this inverse problem of taking data and producing a quantum state from it. And so we can avoid that problem for the most part, but we pay because now we have to perform many more measurements. And I'll discuss it later. Okay, so let me just draw you a little cartoon of what this might look like. Okay, so you know, so here's a block circle, cut through, and say I have this qubit, and it's in the plus z state. Okay, we don't know what it is, so let's make a guess, right? Let's guess that it's here. Now, what the protocol does is it around the guess, it says to do this measurement and this measurement, and count the outcomes, say the plus outcomes for this measurement, and take the difference. And that'll tell me something about the gradient. And if I got more outcomes here, then I should step in that direction. Okay? So there we are. We stepped in that direction. And then we repeat, and we step again in that direction, and then eventually hope that it converges. So here's a simulation for a qubit. There's the true state down here. It's like an echo plus state. And then I start my protocol in the zero state. And I start to do measurements. And I step in the direction of steepest ascent in, say, fidelity, which I estimate from these measurements. And because it's, you know, it's a stochastic process, sometimes I step in the wrong direction. But eventually, I get down. So these are three independent runs, starting from the same state. The difference is due to, you know, doing different measurements and getting different data, okay? And the N here just means when I choose these two measurements to estimate the gradient, I'm repeating them 100 times here and 10,000 times here. So that's why, as you might expect, that, you know, these paths are sort of less volatile. I'll go through the details of this, but this is just kind of what you should have in your mind. And then at the end, I'll show this slide again. This is the trade-off. So, standard. At this point, I'll point out that what I'm describing only works for pure states. So I'm considering the problem of pure state tomography. And if I'm going to measure in, say, trace distance or Hilbert-Schmidt norm or fidelity, I can expect for standard tomography, you know, just from classical arguments, that the error will go down as 1 over the total number of measurements that I've done. And I'll pick up a penalty, which is the dimension. So it's going to scale exponentially, you know, as we would expect. An informationally complete set of measurements for pure states is order D. So, you know, I'm not sure if the story has ended on this, but I think the state of the art is now something like 4D minus 2 or something like that. Anyway, order D. But I've done all these measurements, and you know they're D by D matrices, and I have order D of them, so I need to store order these cubed real numbers. And then after I have all these measurements, I have to do this inversion. And you know, the best I could do is something like least squares. Or just inverting a D by D matrix, then that's going to cost me another D cubed in time at the end. And then we'll see that for the self-guided thing, I'll just be adding vectors, D-dimensional vectors together, and storing one D-dimensional vector at any given time. And so I get some improvement here, but at the cost that every measurement is in a new direction, right? It's a new kind of measurement. Whereas for standard tomography, I envision, you know, fixing an informationally complete set of measurements ahead of time, and repeating them. Here, I'm I'm doing a new measurement for every count in some sense. And then, the fits to the simulate, so I've done some numerical simulations and the fits give me some sort of unfavorable scaling or less favorable scaling. So this eta is like 1.1 or something like that. Oh, I just mean the number of different kinds, the number of different kinds of measurements that I have to do. Yeah. So the number. So if I just take all the measurements that I've done and create one big POVM, the number of elements in that POVM.
Sorry. Can you say again what n total is?
Oh, n total is just the number of copies of the system. I'm envisioning. I press a button. I can do a measurement. And then I re-prepare the system, do a new measurement, re-prepare. So I'm not in the scenario where I can take, you know, n total copies of the system and do one joint entangled measurement. I'm talking about single copies. And there's n total single copies of the system.
But in the first case, you're still doing n total measurements. It's just that some of them are the same measurements.
Some of them are the same, yeah.
And in the second one, you're also doing the same measurement repeatedly.
No, well, it's just that'll be. So it's an iterative algorithm. The thing that will matter is the number of iterations, and the number of repetitions per setting will be fixed at something small, like some constant that's independent of the dimension and the total number of measurements.
Well, I mean, this is another factor in the accuracy, presumably. I mean, I guess I'm just a little confused by the measurement complexity, but maybe that's not very important.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a term that I got from Steve Flamia.
But let's phrase in a different question. Why do we care about the measurement complexity as opposed to just the total number of measurements?
I guess for practical considerations, I suppose. Like, if you're an experimentalist, you have to do some work to design your apparatus.
I understand. For kind of a non-adaptive tomography method, I can see that might be an issue. For adaptive, you know it's not relevant. So yeah, you need to be able to. I mean, it's not the number of measurements that you actually do in the protocol. It's the number of measurements that you might have to do that's relevant. So for adaptive, that's just huge. So you have to have a system that you can do it for.
Yes, sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think we agree. I mean, if your mindset is sort of this thing, you're in this sort of standard tomography mindset, this apparently looks daunting, but if you built the system knowing that you're going to have to change the measurements at every step, then yeah, that's not all that relevant. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You said the technique. You deliberately only apply it to pure states, but if your target state is not actually quite pure, have they explored how much worse the technique performs?
Oh, so if I just naively use it for a mixed state, it'll find the pure state it'll find the eigenvector of that state with maximal eigenvalue. So in some sense, it finds the closest pure state.
Yeah.
I'll discuss how one might generalize the whole thing to mixed states at the end. Okay, so this was kind of motivated by these two papers here, going back a few years now. So they say roughly the same thing. I'll show on the next slide. But one way you can think of this self-guided tomography is adaptive fidelity estimation. So what was the idea in those two papers? So you have some true state, let's assume it's pure, and you think you know what state you're preparing. And so you might not be interested in tomography, maybe you just want to know this number, how close am I in fidelity to this target state that I think it is. And what those papers showed was that you can estimate this fidelity from experiments. You do these measurements and you extract this data and then you might do some small computation. But it certainly doesn't involve multiplying matrices and taking the trace. And the efficiency with which you can do this depends on the target state. So if you know ahead of time that your target state is matrix product state or stabilizer state or from some variational class that has some compact description, then you can do this more efficiently. And it's direct in the sense that you're not calculating things with the Born rule. You're not inverting matrices. You get this measurement data, and from that measurement data, I can do some sort of Monte Carlo summing of this measurement data to get a get a statistical estimate of this fidelity.
So it is saying that if target state is very simple, like NBS state and truth state is very, very complicated, then still I can.
Yes. So my idea was, okay, do that, but just change the target state until the method tells you that the fidelity is close to 1. Okay, so that's, again, maybe easier than it sounds. So here's some slang I picked up in Australia, or maybe Googled it. So this kookaburra over here, he says, if I'm going to step in the right direction in some sense, then I need to know what direction that is. And the space is sort of growing exponentially. So I'm going to sort of have to estimate which direction, sort of independently in all different dimensions, which direction to step in. If I want to estimate, say, the gradient, I need to know which in each orthogonal direction I should step in so that I can get it first estimate the gradient and then take a step in that direction. Besides, if I'm doing all of these linear independent measurements of the fidelity, then I'm more or less doing tomography already. So that you might object that way. Or maybe you might say, well, if you're doing these fidelity estimates and they're close together, then the fidelity itself is going to be close. And due to statistical fluctuations, you're never going to know the correct direction. You're going to step in the completely the opposite direction sometimes. Your method is never going to converge. But if we look in the literature, we can kill two birds with one stone. So this objection over here will be covered by what's called simultaneous perturbation. And over here, by a method called stochastic approximation, and collectively in the literature it's known as SPSA. So what is this? So this is the algorithm. So I've stated it generally. This could be the fidelity, or it could just be any sort of noisy function that I want to maximize. It looks a lot like just a standard gradient method. I have some gain, I have some magnitude, and some direction. And I have my old estimate, and I step in the direction that maximizes, or that is going to suggest that the fidelity or this function value will increase the most. So the simultaneous perturbation, what that is the suggestion that we shouldn't estimate the gradient in all directions. Let's just pick a random direction and decide that we're going to evaluate the gradient, the projection of the gradient in that direction only. And this will reduce the number of times I have to, the number of fidelity estimates that I have to do to 2, independent of dimension. So I'm, no matter how big the dimension is, I'm going to pick a random direction. I'm going to do these two fidelity estimates, take the difference and, divide by how big of a step I took. And that will be an approximation to the gradient, and I'll step in that direction. And then the stochastic approximation, well, that just says, I wanted to estimate the gradient. Well, let me just use a finite difference approximation. And you see that these numbers, these sequences, alpha, the gain, and the step size, and then the direction I choose, they're not, you can't just choose them freely. One has to do the convergence analysis and come up with some conditions on what this sequence has to satisfy in order for you know, this to converge to the true state, say in probability. So I won't go through the details of that. There's not enough time, but I'll just tell you that if you did the convergence analysis, which would involve, you know, just applying this definition recursively, and you would end up with, you might see that you would end up with a sum of such terms, and you come up with these three necessary conditions. This one's kind of like, you know, the sequence has to, you have to take big enough steps to, in some sense, explore the whole space, but you still want it to converge. So you end up with a condition on a sequence that has to converge. And then maybe for the direction that you choose, you might have suspected that, well, they should be independent and have zero mean. But maybe these last two aren't so obvious. The last two are important because they rule out what you might expect to be, you know, your first attempt would be, say, taking a random Gaussian distribution for that. Those don't have finite inverse first and second moments. But something sort of even simpler does, this is called a Rademacher distribution, and it's just, I have this vector, which is the direction I'm going to step in, and I just, for each component, I just choose plus or minus one, chosen according to a coin flip. And so I'm just picking random orthogonal directions to step in. And some sufficient conditions for these, for the gain and the step size, you know, these will satisfy those constraints.
Chris, I got lost on the independent zero mean.
Yeah.
So if it's zero mean, that means its first moment is zero. Is that what the second part is talking about? Finite inverse first and second moments. I mean, if it doesn't matter, I don't care, but I just lost it.
Right, sorry, this is probably... that might be a typo, now I can't recall.
Okay.
I want to say I meant second and third moments, mm-hmm. which would make sense. And if I remember, there were delta cubes, so... more sense. Did you have a question, Kathy?
If you're picking directions at random, if you happen to find a very large gradient in a particular direction in one step, would it be advantageous to try going roughly in the same direction in the next step? Or have you already sort of exploited that gradient by taking a large step in the direction question?
So what I'm describing is sort of the most naive thing you could do, and you know, in the classical literature, state of the art involves choosing them adaptively in such a way. And higher order methods and various you know, variants on such an approach, but I haven't looked into that, but I'll show you that, you know, the most naive approach you can take, you know, that satisfies these conditions still works. But in practice, if someone ever wants to do this, then yeah, you might want to make further improvements by considering such things.
Yeah, so the direction is chosen from some finite.
So the direction is just a vector in and for each step of each iteration of the algorithm, I just choose that vector to be a random orthogonal direction. Right. So each component is going to be plus or minus one, with 50-50 probability. And these are sort of these two things are algorithmic parameters that one can optimize or just choose at random. Okay, so how does this apply to tomography? So remember, we're looking at one of these is pure, so the fidelity is this trace overlap. How does one estimate that from experiments? So let's do such a measurement. So I'm going to test against this state sigma and then the orthogonal complement. Remember, sigma is pure. And then the fidelity will just be the mean of sort of the, you know, the most naive estimator of it, which would be just take the number of times I see sigma over the total number of measurements that I've done. Okay, so when I say do a fidelity estimate, that's what I mean. I mean, repeat n plus n minus times, and then take the empirical ratio of those as an estimate of the fidelity. And again, that's the cartoon. So we're going to, I mean, there's not enough dimensions to think about stepping in a random direction here, but a step in two directions, estimate the gradient, and then take a big step in that direction, so on and so forth. That's what it looks like for a qubit. So for multiple qubits and looking at how the scales in terms of various parameters for the qubit, these numbers will be important. So I run the algorithm for some number of iterations. Per iteration, I have to estimate the fidelity to estimate the gradient. So that's the number of fidelity estimates per iteration. But we're doing this simultaneous perturbation thing. So that's fixed at 2. Okay. But other methods might require more. And the number of measurements per fidelity estimate. So that's the number of times I repeat the same measurement. And that's n. So the total number of measurements will just be 2 times n times k. So I'll run this for many iterations. And then I'll try to fit the infidelity to a power law. So I'll fit this exponent here. So what I found is that beta is approximately 1, and it's more or less independent of the number of times I repeat this measurement, at least for large numbers of measurements. And so that suggests that the infidelity will decrease as the 1 on the total number of measurements that I've made. Okay. Okay, so this is for a single qubit. So I have the number of iterations on the x-axis and the infidelity on the y-axis. And there's 3 curves. One, so they're for the same number of iterations, but the difference is the number of times I repeat. Say, tell me the fidelity for this measure, for this state. So for the blue line, that's repeated 10 times. So if I see up 9 times and down once, then I estimate the fidelity to be 90%. And then the green is for 100 repetitions, and then the red is for 1,000. But if I want to compare this as the total number of measurements, I need to shift the red one over by 1,000, and the green one over by 100, and the blue one over by 10. So, and then I've done that in this inset and superimposed them all on top of each other, and you can kind of believe that they're all sort of landing in the same spot. But initially, I may be quite surprisingly that, you know, the fewer number of measurements, the better. Per iteration. Clear how to read that?
If we do this with n imposed, do we still succeed?
So I remember when I first started, I went down to 1 bit, n equals 1. And it didn't really seem to do anything, but that was probably at the time when my code wasn't working either. So I don't know what the answer is, but the problem is that I'm taking the difference of this estimate. And so my guess is what would be optimal is you continue to repeat until you see a difference. And then you take a step in that direction with that magnitude. Because if I just do one bit for each of them, they're probably going to be the same, and then I won't take a step at all, right? So I should just repeat until I see a difference and then take a step in that direction. But
I mean, if that happens very quickly, presumably you'll take a big step and it'll be very noisy. I mean, your final answer will have to be very noisy. I mean, your gradient is going to be something like how many times do you measure before you see a difference, right? So you'd have to combine that with some kind of ramping down over time of the step size in order to converge on.
Oh yeah, the step size goes down. Those sequences that I showed you, they're decreasing sequences. So the step size.
That's already built in.
Yeah, that's already built in. Right. So yeah. So if I imagine, just classically, say I have some parabola and I want to find the minimum, and I don't change the step size and the function calls are noisy, I'm just going to bounce around, right, with a magnitude given by how much noise there is. But if I change the step size so that it's smaller, well then, it's not obvious why that converges, but it clearly doesn't. It's not susceptible to the same problem. And in fact, it's going to converge, which is already surprising, because it's going to go below what you might suspect to be some noise floor, given by how noisy your estimates are. Of course, this is in probabilities, so you kind of have to wrap your brain around that, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to do that now. So, I mean, for one data point there on the end plot, for the red line, that's 10 to the 3 points to estimate the fidelity.
Yeah.
So how is it possible that you get 10 to the minus 9 accuracy?
Right, and for 10, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going. You might expect that. Well, I can only resolve fidelity.
It's 10 to the 3rd for each point, right? So.
Yeah.
But you're taking 2. Oh, I see. So.
No, it will go to 0. So.
Don't just think that I stopped. It's much larger than 10 to the 3rd, right?
Pardon?
It's 10 to the 3rd for every step you take.
Yeah.
And the previous steps are relevant too. So.
Right.
Yeah.
It's actually a lot more than 10 to the 3rd total measure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's the same plot. The last one was three slices through this thing. And you can kind of see that at some point it sort of plateaus. There's no point in increasing the number of repetitions. There's some transient behavior that shoots down really quickly, just depending on how big my initial step is and how far away my initial start state is. But then they all sort of have this same convergent behavior. Let's go to multi-qubits. So I have 3 qubits, 4, 5, 6, up to 10. So I should have said, for the qubit, I just take a Haar random state as the target. Or sorry, the Haar random state is the true state. And then another different Haar random state is my start state. Here I choose a Haar random state, but I want to know, I don't want to look at this transient behavior. So I choose a random state that's close to it as my start state. And how close? Well, this close. And then to know what the scaling is with the dimension, I want to look at the difference between these. And so that's what the inset is a slice along each of these. And you see that it should be linear if I claim that the accuracy increases linear with dimension, because the dimension is exponential and this is a log plot. Okay, so it's not quite linear, but I think that's just because, again, I chose the most naive algorithm and didn't optimize the parameters, and the theory suggests that it should be linear. So. I would conjecture that it is linear. And it's hard to tell, what's going to happen from here.
Could it be that D is not big enough to see it?
No, I mean, I don't think that's the problem. I just think that, you know, it's difficult to say that this is asymptotic behavior. I mean, I'll mention this again later, but when I submitted this, the referee said, well, you should compare this to like linear inversion or some other standard approach, like maximum likelihood estimation. I mean, it's kind of an unfair comparison, because if I'm going to do maximum, so remember, the complexity of in doing, say, maximum likelihood estimation or linear inversion or least squares increases with the number, you know, the size of your data set. And so I'm doing all of these new measurements. And so first of all, the measurements are so close together that this is going to be a horribly ill-conditioned inverse problem. So if I try to do that, just doing a single run for one qubit takes the same amount of time that all of the other simulations combined over up to like 14 qubits that I did took, because again of this OD versus OD squared times the number of measurements required to do standard tomography. And then a little bonus. I apologize. I've changed what kind of state I'm looking at. So now I'm looking at sort of a W-like state. So the dimension now is just n, the number of qubits instead of exponential, just so I can kind of extract more of the asymptotic behavior. So what I'm doing here is, I have this guess state, and then I'm going to take two little steps next to it to estimate the gradient. But I'm still assuming I know those, you know, exactly what those measurement axes are. What happens if those are noisy too, and I don't know what they are? Well, the method still converges in that case. So in the tomography literature, this is known as SPAM. State preparation and measurement errors. The state preparation doesn't really matter for state tomography. That's more relevant for process tomography. But the measurement errors, what you'll see in standard tomography is you'll see some plateau. You'll never get beyond, you never get below some accuracy that's how well you know what measurement axes you're actually using. So what are these simulations? How are these simulations done? So remember, I have some guess, and the actual measurements that I'm going to do are slight deviations in some random direction about that guess. But what really happens is I do those, but then there's some added noise. And well, what I mean here is just whatever the dimension of this is, I'm going to, each component in whatever representation I'm using, I'm going to add some white noise to it of this amount of strength. And I was kind of happily surprised that it still converges. I guess it's not surprising. The method is supposed to be insensitive to noise, and so it, in some sense, it doesn't really matter where that noise is coming from, whether it's statistical or some sort of technical noise. I guess it's important that this is sort of uncorrelated noise. The important thing is that not necessarily that the noise is independent on these two fidelity estimates from iteration to iteration, but that the two of them are independent per iteration, so they can't be correlated, so obviously, or on average, they won't be the correct gradient. But you could have slowly varying noise that is correlated on long time scales, so that on fast time scales where I'm doing the estimates, they're independent, but maybe on long time scales they aren't. That's fine. And you'll still see this convergence. Okay, so what did you learn? So kind of a new take on tomography, where instead of doing this inversion, you kind of do a direct approach. And by doing that, you see some sort of a trade-off in the amount of time and space you need to get an estimate of the state. But you have to do more measurements than you might suspect if you were thinking about standard tomography. And that's that same slide again. Right, so I think I have some final comments. So let's start over here, right? So what about processes? The standard thing to do when you write a tomography paper is you write about state tomography, and then you say, oh, well, all of this will hold for channels because I can just use the Choi-Jamakowski isomorphism, and every channel has an equivalent representation of the state, and well, then apply my result. It's unclear in the adaptive scenario that this such a thing is. I mean, naively, you just can't do that because now I have more experimental choices. I can choose the input states and the measurements that I do on those input states after it goes through the process. So I don't know what the answer is there.
Sorry, I don't know. I mean, so presumably the analog of pure states would be unitaries.
Exactly, yeah.
And can't you just say, well, I'll take the, U applied to half of an entangled state as my state, and then do this tomography on that, and then?
Sure, yeah, I suppose. I was thinking more. I don't think if I suggested that to an experimentalist, I don't think that they would like that. They want to see more. I mean, I'm just thinking of the standard, not ancilla assisted, but the standard approach to process tomography. But yeah, I think that might work.
They don't like the standard approach to process tomography either.
See. Well, maybe, hopefully, if I could generalize it, maybe they would. I don't know. But now that you say that, I'm actually thinking. Well, one way that I was thinking about this approach was, the measurements are encoding a description of the state you think it is, and so you can think of the estimate of the fidelity is just some black box, and so if you say all my experimental choices encode my description of the state, then I could sort of naively apply this approach if I had some black box that estimated the fidelity between two unitaries. Did you?
Apply.
Yeah. And then it catches question about mixed states. If I just applied this naively, where the true state was a mixed state, right? I'm looking at the trace overlap. Well, what maximizes the trace overlap? It's the maximal eigenvalue. So I won't find a mixed state. I'll find a pure state if I just naively maximize this trace overlap. So the question is, how do I extract the fidelity of between two mixed states, or between a target mixed state and the true mixed state from an experiment? There's some suggestions from Zukowski and Ullman and others about how one would do it for another quantity called the superfidelity. But there you require two copies of the state. But maybe fidelity is not the right answer. Really, you just need some measure, which is sort of nice, has some nice properties, and is uniquely maximized at the true state. So if you have such a measure that you can also sort of estimate from experiments, that would be good. And then another question is, well, again, I just plugged in the most naive thing I could kind of find. Such an algorithm is part of a larger class of algorithms. They go by the various names because they span all sorts of literature, from queuing theory to machine learning. And so, the most common ones are active learning and reinforcement learning. And so they're all these iterative update algorithms that say, my new state will be close to my old state, but I want to do some forgetting and some remembering. So I trade off between how much I forget what my old estimate was and how much I keep that estimate. Okay, so those are sort of questions I would like answered. Because this is an optimized, at the heart, it's an optimization routine where I don't really have access to some black box that tells me the numerical value, but I can sort of simulate outcomes from the correct function. And so we've applied that to quantum control. So with Osama Musa, I should suggest, first we come up with an acronym, and the acronym we like the best, and then that's the research we do. So it all starts with acronym, adaptive control by randomized optimization, nearly yielding maximization. And so we call this in situ control. So we're, instead of the current paradigm, which is on a classical computer, I simulate the dynamics for some control pulse that I'm going to input. And I do some sort of classical simulation routine, and I maximize, you know, with standard non-stochastic algorithms, my fidelity. So some you may have heard of grape or drag. These are routines which classically simulate the evolution of the wave function. And since I know the wave function at the end, I can just calculate this probability distribution. I don't need to do simulations of, you know, single shots of data. But that only works in really, you know, restricted scenarios. And it also only works if I know exactly what the Hamiltonian is of my system. And I know exactly what the parameters of that Hamiltonian are, and so on. So we have a scheme where, you know, naively you just say, well, let me try some controls, let the system evolve, and then estimate how good that set of controls were. Now, they would have done this, you know, 10, 20 years ago, but the reason that it works is because now we can estimate the fidelity of some control sequence efficiently using things like direct fidelity estimation and randomized benchmarking. So that really enabled this sort of approach. So there's just a little plot from the paper where, you know, ex situ means I did it offline and I had the wrong Hamiltonian. In situ means I just allow the system itself to do its own simulation. And then Chris Grenade, who was here and at IQC, used that algorithm as a subroutine in a genetic algorithm to do quantum control in his thesis. So that one's mimetic optimal quantum assisted control algorithm, MOCA. And then Josh, Chris, and Steve Lamia and I are thinking about not control at the physical level, but trying to just directly improve logical operations. And their standard control techniques, such as grape and drag, just don't apply because I don't have sort of the nice input-output relationship that's required to make use of those algorithms. And so BBQ means black box quantum control, and charcoal is characterization of quantum logical operations. So hopefully we can use these stochastic optimization ideas to improve the fidelity of encoded operations. And that's all. Thank you.
Questions? So I'm not familiar with tomography, but are these statements, can we prove it? Or?
One can look at the classical literature, and the problem with classical signal analysis and statistics and so forth is you usually say, I have some data, and it's given by some function, some deterministic function, plus some additive noise, right? But quantum mechanics isn't like that, right? I don't have a deterministic function and additive noise on top of it. I have some probability distribution that I sample from. But, you know, asymptotically, I can treat, say, sampling from the binomial distribution as something like this. So, so with a little hand waving, I say, asymptotically, this approach will look like this. I show that the fidelity obeys the regularity conditions required by the convergence theorem, and then I say, such a thing converges. Now, looking directly at the sampling distribution given by the Born rule and trying to do the convergence analysis is something I haven't done yet. So it's something that I would like to see done. The short answer is maybe, depending on how much rigor you demand.
So I'm not sure. I have some comment about this mixed state fidelity estimation.
Sure.
I'm not sure if it's actually useful, but basically the point that I want to make is that there is an expression for the fidelity that is written in terms of some minimization problem, and this is, let's say I want to estimate the fidelity between like rho and sigma.
Right.
This looks like a minimized trace of rho A, where A is some Hermitian operator, plus a trace of sigma B, where B is also some Hermitian operator, and you have some constraints on A and B.
Okay.
So this minimization problem under the right constraints gives you the fidelity.
Right.
And in your case, the first part of this minimization problem, you already have a guess for rho, and you can, given A, you can certainly calculate it.
Right.
And for the second part, you can certainly estimate it if you know what B is, as long as it's not something too crazy. So I was wondering if maybe it's not impossible to use this definition.
Right.
To somehow simultaneously minimize things correctly so that you can maybe estimate the mixed state fidelity.
Yeah. I know I've looked at some of the alternate characterizations of the fidelity, but not wholeheartedly. But that one sounds vaguely familiar. I'll have a look. It's not obvious to me whether it will work or not, but yeah, it's a good suggestion. Thanks. Yeah.
So it occurred to me while you're talking that there's something, I don't know, maybe people thought about this, but if you think of a qubit and you're getting these fidelity estimates, so I'm not even talking about a gradient, just pick a direction, measure in that direction, and then you'll get some projection of the fidelity, which is like a ring of states around there. So you get a ring on the block sphere, and then just pick another random direction, and you'll get an estimate of the fidelity, and then you'll have two rings that intersect.
Right.
And so then you need a third ring, which will find the sort of unique point. Is there any...
I thought about this. My conclusion was that it would be equivalent to tomography. But you're kind of triangulating quantum state, right? I guess it would give you some nice, some nice region, right? Because there'd be some noise, and so you'll get some ribbon.
Right.
But, if you think about the triangulation problem, you have to do one more measurement than the dimension.
Right.
So I think it would be equivalent to tomography, but I don't. It's interesting. I don't know. There might be something there. Like one could do this fidelity estimation with, there are bases that are composed of say nice states like stabilizer states or something, and instead of having an estimate as a solution of this triangulation problem, I just keep those numbers, the distance to an informationally complete set of states, around, and maybe I can do things with that, rather than try to do the inverse problem first. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's something that
it obviously gets worse in high dimension. Like
I've never heard anyone discuss that, but it's something that I've thought about.
Any other questions? All right, well, let's thank Chris again.
Thanks.